And because we have to figure out how I'm going to assign a mark for you. And secondly, there is now a schedule of times on Wednesdays that we will meet. So we're meeting today, obviously, and we'll meet next week also. So next two meetings. So actually, meetings next week. Will be Monday, 10 to 12, and Wednesday, 1:30 to 3. And somewhere, at some point, a website will be created for the course, and I'll post all the dates and times.
Yeah.
No, number 3 seminar starts at 3.
Oh, okay.
Unless you have another number 3 seminar.
Yeah.
I hope it doesn't start at 2. It used to be at 3. Yeah, yeah, no, I want to attend the number 3 seminar too. Okay, so let's, I give you an overview of some of the topics we want to think about during the course. I'm going to start off slowly. We're going to have to ramp up a little bit. But anyway, even for today, we're still talking about background, so reminding you of a few things and then proving a few things. So firstly, let's see, where should I start? Yeah, okay, maybe it's a good idea to keep in mind some spaces you should be familiar with. If everyone here has already had a beginning course in algebraic geometry, you don't need this, but I'm assuming there are some here who haven't. Correct me if I'm wrong. Am I wrong? Okay, so firstly, I'm working over a field. We'll get to working over a ring later on. So some field. Then you have affine space over K, affine N space, which you all know. And the other thing that you should know is projector space. Okay. Now, projector space is going to occur many times, partly as an ambient space and partly also as a first special case of a more general object known as Grassmannians. And Grassmannians are going to play an important role when we come to discussing arithmetic. So I just wanted to say maybe one word about projector space. Projector space consists of so I have some vector space V, and I'm looking, I guess, at dimension n plus 1. And projective space consists of one-dimensional subspaces. Or another way of saying it is, if you think of having fixed some basis, so this is a highly non-canonical way of describing it, n plus 1, then I'm looking at, so in n plus 1 dimensional space over K, I'm looking at lines through the origin. And those things fit together to form first a space, a topological space, and then in fact it's an algebraic variety. As I said, I'm going to look also at Grassmannians later on. So Grassmannians are generalizations of projective space where we look at, let's say, R-dimensional subspaces of V. And in some cases, it's the more natural space to think of, more natural ambient space for various geometric constructions. Okay, you are familiar with, we keep some these things on this board, the Zariski topology. On the other hand, maybe it's too important to relegate the corner. You're familiar with the Zariski topology. And so here I'm working either in, let's say, either in affine space or projective space, where we say that the closed sets are those closed set in AN is a set of zeros, the locus of zeros of a finite set of polynomials in, let's say, this K bracket. That's in AN, and closed set in PN is the locus of the zeros of a homogeneous finite set of homogeneous polynomials. That's the only extra word you need to add here. So those are the closed sets. Complements are all declared to be open sets, and that defines the topology. And one also has the notion of an irreducible set is one which is not the union of proper closed sets. Then an algebraic variety is an irreducible closed set. So here I will say, I guess I have to specify an affine or projective algebraic variety is an irreducible closed subset of AN or PN. In other words, it's a set whose points can be identified as the set of zeros of some family of polynomials. And in the projective case, you have to require that the polynomials be homogeneous. The reason being that if you don't have a homogeneous polynomial, it doesn't make sense to speak of a zero in projective space, right? Because polynomials are only defined up to a scalar. Okay. So this is meant to be kind of a quick recall. If you don't know this, then you can find it in the first in any book on algebraic geometry. On the other hand, if you want me to go over it, just raise your hand and we'll spend a little bit more time on it. Okay. That's that. The next thing I need to tell you about is dimension of a variety. So if I have an algebraic variety, then I can speak of its dimension. And what is this? This is transcendence degree over K of the function field. So I didn't define the function field, but it's, you see, the point is that so I have these are okay, so we need to do a little bit more. Let me just leave it at this, that K of X is the field of functions, field of rational functions on X. Yeah, actually, if you want to think of it like this, let's say I'm dealing with an affine variety, then I have polynomials, K bracket X bracket X1 to XN. I can look at their restriction to this subset. You see, X is, if it's an affine variety, it's a subset of AN. So I can take a polynomial and restrict it to this subset. So that gives me some function on this subset. So the collection of such functions will form a nice ring, and its quotient field is called the function field. Similarly, in projective space, I look at homogeneous polynomials in n variables, and then if I have a closed set, if a variety is after a closed subset of the n, I can restrict those functions to this subset, and that gives me a set of functions on this subset. Again, taking their quotient field, I get a field k of x. It is clearly a domain because, in fact, it's a quotient of this integral domain, k bracket x1 to xn. So that forms a field. Now, in general, that field will be a transcendental extension of k. So, maybe say one more example. Take affine space itself. Then what is affine space itself is an algebraic variety where the set of, so which, to claim it's an algebraic variety, I have to give you a finite set of polynomials in there such that affine space is a set of zeros, right? Right, by definition? Way, nod if it makes sense. And nod this way or shake your head this way if it doesn't make sense. And this way, so you sort of think you can figure it out. So in affine space, if I claim this is a variety, what is the finite set of polynomials whose zero set gives you? Yeah, yes, go ahead. The empty set, right? Or the zero polynomial, correct. So in this case, then, if I take, so that's right, I don't need any polynomial to define it. So then what's the field of rational functions? Well, to get it, I take this ring of polynomial functions and I restrict it to that set. There's nothing to restrict to. It's the whole thing. So in this case, the function field is just k of x1 to xn. It's the quotient field of that polynomial ring in n variables. So it's just rational form. This notation means the quotient field of that ring of polynomials. In other words, quotients of polynomials in n variables. And these x1 to xn, of course, are variables. They're transcendental over the ground field, k. So in this case, the dimension is n, which is, of course, what it should be. Otherwise, it would be a highly unintuitive concept. Okay? So, or another example, suppose I took inside affine 2 space, suppose I took a curve, y squared equals f of x. Then when I take polynomials in there and try to restrict it to this curve, what I will get is something like this, f of x, y, k, every polynomial, but the ones which are polynomials in x and y which are multiples or which are divisible by this one will not contribute anything, right? Because, for example, this polynomial y squared minus f of x lives in here, but if I restrict it to this set, it's zero, correct? So it gives me the zero function. So that one doesn't count for anything. And in fact, any multiple of this also won't count for anything. So the set of functions on this, the restriction of this space of functions to this curve is in fact this quotient. Okay, can be identified with this quotient. It's isomorphic to this quotient. In other words, the map kfxy restriction to this points on this curve xy such that y squared equals f of x, the image of that map is isomorphic to this. By this bracket, I mean ideal generated by so there's some ideal sitting inside here, and the quotient is clearly the set of functions. And now if I ask you what is the dimension of this variety, well, this field, you see, what is it? If this is irreducible, this is in fact going to be a field. And what I have is here's k adjoint x, and then k adjoint x comma y, but now y satisfies a quadratic polynomial in x. So this is a degree 2 extension. So this is algebraic. But this part is transcendental. So the transcendence degree is 1, which is what you'd expect. The dimension of a curve should be 1. Okay, does this all make sense to everyone? Comfortable with that? Okay. Next thing to talk about is actually an interesting okay. So let's say I have a morphism of varieties. So I told you sort of last time what that means. It's given by rational functions, actually it's given by regular functions, polynomial functions in the coordinates. So you say that such a thing is dominating or dominates, is dominating if the image is dense. So we have a topology that we're working with, so all these notions of open, closed, dense and so on make sense. And what do I need to tell you about dominating morphisms? I just need to tell you the following fact, that if you have a dominating map, then the dimension, there's the following relation in the dimensions. The dimension of y is less than or equal to dimension of x. Again, very intuitively clear. And the argument here is just as follows, that if let's say z is, let's see, actually I don't need z here. If it's dominating, then in fact we have an injection. The argument is this, that f induces an injection of function fields. And so the transcendence degree of k of x is at least that of k of y. Okay. Okay. So that's... Yeah. Yeah. The curve? From k, yeah, but this is not k of x, y, it's sort of, I'll say like this. So this is isomorphic to a field, okay, k adjoined two elements, alpha and beta, where x gets mapped to alpha and y gets mapped to beta, and beta is has the relationship beta squared is f of alpha. Yeah, so really this is the function field. Okay, so we have these things. Now, what did I want to tell you about that? Those are some preliminaries. Next, we should talk about complete maps and complete varieties a little bit. Oh, wait a minute. Maybe I can tell you something else first before we get there. Yeah, actually, I want to prove a theorem about dimension. So here's the theorem. And it's elementary, but it's extremely useful. So suppose f from x to y is a dominating morphism. And let us set. So firstly, I know now if f is dominating, the dimension of y is at most the dimension of x, so set r to be the difference of the dimensions. and let W in Y be a closed irreducible set. Okay, now let's consider the inverse image under. So I have basically a subvariety of Y. These are all, I'm not stating it, X and Y are algebraic varieties, of course. So I have a subvariety of Y and I look at its pre-image, which may not be irreducible, so let Z be a component, an irreducible component. So I defined what it means to be irreducible. If something's not irreducible, you can decompose it as a union of irreducibles. And each one of those irreducibles is called an irreducible component. Very natural kind of notion. In this case, the dimension of Z is at least the dimension of W plus R. Okay, so let's see why that is the case. Another way of saying it, sort of naively, is the map X to Y, think of it as kind of a fibering of X over Y. So I have here Y, and I have X. Here's X mapping to it. And generically, the fibers should have dimension R. Right? If I have a dimension X variety mapping to a dimension Y variety, generally you should think the fibers should have dimension of the difference. I mean, think of the trivial case where this is a product. Let's say, for example, X is actually Y times some variety, times F. Where then you could think, you see that the dimension of this thing is the dimension of this plus the dimension of this. So the in general, it's not a product, it's something twisted, but the fibers you expect should be, like intuitively, should be of dimension R. Dimension R. And what this is saying is now I'm not taking a point, but suppose I take a dimension W subset here, then the inverse image or even a component of it should be, should have dimension this plus this, because the inverse image will be this whole thing. Okay, that's the intuition. And a corollary of this is the following. If I take W to be zero dimensional, so if W is a point, so dimension W equals zero, then a component, actually any component, Z, of F inverse of Y has dimension at least R. And the proof of the theorem is like this. As I said, it's not a hard theorem. So here is, now I'm going to change my picture a little bit. I like ovals. Here's X, and here's Y, and F is mapping. Like that. And here is, let's say, I have my closed subset W. Closed subset. And let's say here Z is a component of the inverse image. Okay? So F maps the Z into W. Okay, now let's take, I want to just, proofs of these kinds, by the way, almost always, the general technique, you reduce to an affine case. So here, let's take some affine open, an affine open neighborhood, of W. In other words, not a neighborhood, I want affine open subset of Y with U meeting W non-trivially. So some affine set, open set, that meets a W. You see, open sets are dense in the Zariski topology. So if I have this closed set, then and I should be able to find an open set that intersects it non-trivially. Okay. Now I'm going to restrict map from W to just this part. So I have F, which maps F inverse of U to U, and inside here I have Z intersected with F inverse of U, and here, inside here, I've got W intersected with U, and again F takes back to that. So in other words, I'm looking at this part and this part here, some part here. By restricting to this map, it this essentially means that if we can prove the theorem, prove the, our result here, you see, if I can prove that this component, Z intersected with this inverse image of this, Z intersected with this open set, has that dimension property, then I have it for Z itself. And so this, by this method, I'm essentially, this is essentially reduction to the case Y is affine. Okay, so let's set R is that, so let's set S to be the codimension of W in Y, in other words, dimension of Y minus dimension of W. So what does that mean? That means that there are functions F1 to Fs so that W is an irreducible component of the locus F1 equals 0 in other words, W is contained in this set. Now let G, now you, these are functions there, these are functions on Y, but I can pull them back to X via F. So let GI be F composed with FI. Okay, I just pull these functions that are locally defining W back to X via F. Then I clearly have that Z is contained in the locus of G1 equals 0, GS equals 0. And in fact, you can show that, so it looks like Z is a component of this, but in fact, you can prove that Z actually, no, actually, that's it. That is a component of this. So what that means is that the codimension of Z is at least S. You see, because to get Z from X, I have to cut it down by at least S equations. Right? So that means the dimension of, but maybe I need more equations because this is, could be a proper component of this. So that tells me that the codimension is at least S. But that's pardon?
If
what? Yeah, if not only that they're not independent. Yeah, that's right. That's right. They could all be the same, for example. Or I might need more equations to define z. That would be the reason why the dimension would go down. Pardon? No, I don't need that here, actually, because I'm only using inequalities. I'm not saying that, you see, to have this, the thesis.
That
Except that here I have it as a full irreducible component. No, I think actually this inequality is okay. I'm sorry, did I write this correctly? No, hold on. Codimension, so what I want to say is, to get z, I need at least s equations. And so, what this tells me, or rather what it tells me, is that the dimension, I want an upper bound on the codimension, not a lower bound. Actually, what I want to say is this. Then I think you don't have a count. Sorry, I meant an upper bound. But if the codimension is at most S, that means that the dimension is at least the dimension of X. I mean, this is the same thing as saying codimension is at most S. But in that case, maybe I should write it here. Yeah, codimension of z is at most s. Therefore, the dimension of z is at least dimension of x minus s. So, in other words, dimension of z is at least dimension of x is r plus the dimension of y. And dimension of w is s. So this is, the codimension of W is S. So this is R plus the dimension of W, which is what I wanted here. Okay, so this is kind of elementary, but it's very, very useful for keeping track of dimensions of the inverse images of basically fibers. And this corollary here. Okay. I think that is basics. Okay. Next, we should talk about complete varieties. So this is a algebraic geometric analog of compactness. In fact, the development of algebraic geometry is to a large extent guided by topology. Each topological notion has some algebraic geometric analog, or under some maybe additional hypotheses. So topological conditions require make assumptions about the underlying ground field, whereas you want to have something completely abstract that works in any characteristic. And so each topological concept, such as connectedness, irreducibility, compactness, has over the years been morphed into an algebraic geometric concept. So here is, and sometimes, by the way, that formulation has taken many years. And so when you see the definition in the algebraic geometry context, it may not be clear what the connection is with the topology. But that's because the concept evolved over some period of time. So here we have the concept of completeness, and the version is I'm going to use is the following. So X variety over K is complete if for all Y over K, the projection map X cross Y to Y is closed. A closed map means, of course, that it takes closed sets to closed sets. And whatever the rationale for defining completeness in this way, it has the following properties, which is the way we will use it. So that's what I want to draw your attention to. Intuitively, by the way, what completeness should make you think of is there are no missing points. That's why it's called complete. For example, suppose you have the affine line. It's missing a point at infinity, so it's not complete. Whereas if you projective line is complete. And in general, projective varieties are complete. So there's different levels of intuition. You can either think of it as a geometric substitute for compactness, or you can think of it as something like there are no missing points. If you were to take limits of things, you still have the limit will be contained in the set. Okay. So here are the properties of complete varieties that we will need to use. In some sense, you could say that I could ignore completely the notion of completeness. Because we will be dealing with a billion varieties which are projective and therefore complete. But sometimes constructions throw you out of that category, as you'll see. And so then it's useful to understand this as a separate notion. So firstly, if I have a complete variety and a closed subset, sub-variety, then Y is also complete. So it's a hereditary property. Secondly, projective space is complete. And this, by the way, you might think it's sort of, okay, let me go home and try to prove this from the definition. This is a highly non-trivial fact. It is essentially equivalent to one of the classical theorems of elimination theory. Classical geometers knew a lot about working with polynomials in many variables, and there's a fundamental theorem called the first result of elimination theory, and the completeness of P to the Pn is essentially that. Okay. Third, by the way, make this a little intuitive for you, this one. Just look at the picture. So I'm trying to prove Y is complete. So I have to show that this map, this projection is closed. And the way I will try to do it is to compare it with this injection and this projection. Try to prove that closed subset here is closed here because Y is closed in X. Thirdly, if I have a map from X to Y, with x complete, then firstly the image is closed and complete. So of course not the case, if x are not complete, the image need not be closed. The standard example is, let's say, xy equals 1, the hyperbola. And if you project it onto either of the axes, you'll get the whole axis minus 1 point. See? So the image is not closed. That's an example of a non-complete variety. Yeah, and to see this, you just compare, you look at f of x. Again, you want to show this map is closed. So you compare that with this map, and this map being f cross 1. This is not meant to be proof. This is the key diagram that she has to give the proof. And fourthly, if I have a map from x to y with x complete and y affine, then f is constant. So you cannot put a complete variety into an affine variety, you know, other than the dimension, other than just a point. So this last one here, the idea here is so firstly from property 3, the map of x into y, since x is complete, 3 tells me that the image is closed and complete. So really I just need to look at subvarieties, complete subvarieties of an affine variety to prove. So therefore 4 is equivalent to saying the only complete subvarieties of an affine variety are of dimension 0. In other words, and since the subvariety is irreducible, it meets the point. So how do you see that? Well, this you can see quite concretely. You see, if I have, let's say, W is complete, W sitting inside Y with Y affine, then any affine variety can be embedded into a projective variety. You know how to do that. You have, it's defined by equations, ordinary equations, F1 to FR, let's say, equals 0. Then you homogenize each of the variables where you have, let's say, for example, when you had this equation here, y squared equals f of x, then you would make a substitution. Capital Y is capital Y over z is little y, and capital X over z is little x, and then you'd make that substitution, right? So this would be y squared. Let's say this is x cubed plus 1. So this would be x cubed plus 1. So that's what's that? What is this? X cubed plus z cubed times z. Is that right? Did I do it right? Yes? At least tell me the simple question's answer. Did I do it right? Yes? Okay. So this is the affine curve, and I can put it into projective space by changing the coordinates in this way. So now I have a homogeneous equation. So in that way, I can always embed W into some projective space, and I can look at into some projective space. So I have, and the image will be some closed thing. Whereas you see now, when I did this, when I introduced the Z, this thing has more points than this because it intersects the hyperplane at infinity. This thing, this W bar, intersects non-trivially the hyperplane at infinity. So here, what is the hyperplane at infinity? It's a hyperplane given by Z equals 0. So when Z is 0, you get a point, namely X is 0, and then Y can be anything. Right? So this curve has a point which this doesn't have. So just in exactly the same way, this variety which is sitting inside an affine, when I projectivize it, the closure will intersect the hyperplane at infinity in a non-trivial way. What does that mean? That means the closure is not W. Okay? It's properly bigger than W. But what does property 3 say? Property 3 says that this W was assumed to be complete. So if I map a complete variety, I get a closed. The image is closed. So it cannot be this unless W were just a point. Okay? The only way W bar would not contain this hyperplane at infinity is if W was simply a point. So that forces dimension of W, therefore, dimension of W is 0. So this is quite a nice fact that you cannot embed a complete variety into an affine variety. Okay. So that's what I want to say about complete varieties. Now with that introduction, let's start talking about abelian varieties. Firstly, the name, by the way, comes not because the group is commutative. They're called abelian varieties not because the group is commutative. In fact, commutative groups are called abelian because Abel studied them. And the variety that actually Abel worked on was the Jacobian of a curve. So he proved some properties of that, and that Jacobian happened to be a commutative group. So because Abel worked on it, it became known as an abelian variety, and it had this additional property that the group law is commutative. Now any commutative group is called abelian. So these things are called abelian varieties not because the group law is commutative, but because Abel studied them. Although he never studied them in this generality, but it's okay. So, I guess last time I was talking about abelian varieties over a finite field. It doesn't really matter at the moment. Everything we say is general, and I make no assumption about the characteristic. Some of these things may require an algebraically closed field, but I don't think we need to worry about that right now. So I have an abelian variety over K. What is it? It is a complete algebraic variety with morphisms that turn A into an algebraic group. So this M you should think of as the composition law, and iota you should think of as the inverse map. In other words, the inverse of an element is iota of that element. Okay, so by abuse of notation, we will write AB for M of AB and A inverse for iota of A. Okay, so I won't explicitly note, otherwise it will become cumbersome. First proposition, is that A is smooth. So I didn't define what a singular point is, but maybe I'll just say it in words, and we can discuss it more if people want. A singular point is something that looks like, in the case of a curve, you see, something which is smooth. This is like a first-year calculus type of definition. Something which is smooth, like that. You can draw it like a smooth thing. But something which is singular maybe would look like that, or would have an intersection like that. The precise definition is this, that I can define at every point something which plays the role of a tangent space. So think of a manifold. Okay, for a manifold, at every point I have a notion of a tangent space. Now that notion can be made completely algebraic. So even in the category of varieties, you can define tangent space at a point. As I go from point to point, the dimension of that tangent space should, in general, be the same as the dimension of the variety. So, for example, if I have a curve like this, you see, let's make it a little bit more. If I take the tangent space, this is a one-dimensional object, the tangent space is also one-dimensional. And that one dimension stays, this one-dimensionality of the tangent space stays everywhere. But if I come to a point like this, you see what this thing, suddenly the tangent space becomes two-dimensional. So one definition of non-singularity is that the tangent space stays constant dimension everywhere. There are no points at which the tangent space dimension jumps. Okay? So that's, this is the, maybe the really extremely intuitive way of thinking of smoothness. What I just told you is sort of an intermediate intuitive level of smoothness. And then a third way is I can write down the definition of a tangent space and tell you that the dimension stays constant. Okay. But here what I'm going to say is just this, that A is a non-singular variety. Well, it turns out that you can always find a smooth point. You can find a point at which the variety is smooth. So that we'll start off with that. So let X naught be a smooth point. Smooth meaning smooth and non-singular are the same. That is non-singular.